Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery, and this week I'm joined by Mike Seymour because it's a special occasion for us. It's our one-year anniversary for our podcast. I can't believe we made it through the whole year.
It was really funny because when we started talking about the podcast way back in the day, I was thinking, yeah, it'd be really good to do some kind of audio interview. And you know what, John? For me, it was something that Jeff did. Jeff recorded an interview with the guys over Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And the idea was he wasn't going to have time to write it up. And he said, well, I'll just do the interview and I'll give it to you and you can write it up. And he gave it to me. And we listened to it on the way back from Vegas. Like, it must have been a year, not last NAB, the one before. And I'm sitting there listening to this thing that Jeff's doing with this guy from wherever that was. And I was thinking, this is really interesting. I could really go for having this in my car when I'm driving to work. And then I think I contacted you and you were like similarly thinking the same
thing.
Yeah,
yeah. You said, you know what? This would be a great idea. I'm like, well, you know what? Here's all this research I've been doing. Because you're right. It would be a great idea. So it's been fun. It's been good.
And Jeff started it.
Yeah, Jeff did start it. And that's why it's special when we hear his voice on our podcast. He's got that radio smooth voice. Well, you know what? But he's got that smooth jazz voice for radio. I've really enjoyed it. I mean, I remember being in my summer last year. I think one of the first ones we did, or one of the earlier ones we did, was a double negative two-parter breaking down Batman Begins. And actually, I remember laying in a pool on an inflatable raft, listening to the podcast, which I'm not sure maybe I should be admitting that, but it was actually really, really enjoyable. And I'm like, you know what? I think we're onto something. That was a great one, I think.
Yeah, it was good. It was, I mean, I guess we all have favorites. I like the Cinefix one. Talking to a legend in Don Shea from Cinefix was a huge one for me. That was a little time after, though. The Batman one was good.
Yeah, no, that we really, really enjoyed my, you know, and the one favorite doing with you is the Super Bowl. I don't think I've laughed so hard in ages.
Oh, that was pretty funny. Yeah, yeah. And you know what? The NAB ones were great fun on the same score. Like, I guess we had to edit those down a bit because they got a bit raucous. But yeah, the NAB ones were a lot of fun. I think people liked those.
Yeah, and a lot of people, I think, really appreciated those too. We actually, our listenership, we have really, really good listenership every week. But those hit kind of a peak during that time, which I think was kind of cool too. I think from the feedback we got, it seemed like listeners enjoyed hearing about the show from the perspective of other users and not just reading, you know, press releases and the like.
But my favorite of all time is Andreas. Andreas is a really good friend of ours. Used to be a senior technology officer at Method. And he was like, you're doing a podcast? Well, why the hell are you wasting your time with that? Nobody wants to hear everybody just talking about their week and what they've been up to. And it's just boring as, and they're over.
That was so 90s. It's so 90s. Yeah. And we were just devastated.
Yeah, we were like, well, we're thinking we might do something kind of technical and quite serious, and then people could, you know, because you hear people in their own voice talking about stuff, and we can get really technical with them and quite informative and be serious. And he's like, nah, never going to work.
And thankfully, he kind of he retracted that a little bit, I think, right? He came back and said, you know what, these are actually really quite good. So that was kind of nice, actually. Because, you know, when someone whose technical opinion you really respect a lot basically tells you it's a bad idea, it's like, oh, okay. All right, then. So what have we got going for this week, Mike?
Well, this week we've got a really good podcast. It's Superman, or rather Superman Returns.
And great buzz on that film.
Well, yeah, the film that conveniently picks up, skipping the last two sequels and assuming that no one watched them, missing the Richard Pryor computer takes over the world and eats Superman with wires, which was a great, you know, Superman 3, I think it was really a lost film in terms of hokey quality. But anyway, Superman Returns has everything that film didn't have. It's incredibly high quality, really gorgeous visual effects, and been contributed to by a large number of companies, including Rising Sun Pictures, who we sat down with and discussed their shots, and that was some, you'll hear that in a moment, that's really, really fascinating. But also in the written story, we talked to Rhythm and Hughes and Sony Pictures Imageworks and a number of the players regarding their contributions to Superman, because as the case with most of these films, John, they're now split between many, you know, facilities. Yep. Across the world.
Yeah, definitely. So who did you speak with in this week's podcast?
Tim Crosby is the visual effects supervisor from Rising Sun, and we talked to him about it's kind of interesting. They had two lots of shots. One was the X-ray vision, the fairly iconic X-ray vision that that Superman has. I mean, they did a bunch of other stuff as well, of course. And then they had the young Clark scenes where he was running through cornfields. Now, I don't know if you remember in the first Richard Donner 1978 film, they had Clark running beside, or Superman running beside, a train. And I always felt it was kind of like a really good attempt, but just didn't work completely.
Right.
So these guys were entrusted at Rising Sun Pictures with the job of doing the, in this case, it's the young Clark running through cornfields. And the idea was that this would be, and they shot this, in fact, a huge real cornfield with massive 500-foot high towers with a 1,000-foot kind of range on the wire rig so that they could fly the young actor through the cornfields. Now, the thing is, while it worked considerably better than the original 78 film, the fact of the matter is it's still incredibly hard to get weight on a character that's being suspended and doesn't really look like they're running. Plus, the direction was that the young Clark should have a whole lot of fun, should be really, like, you know, discovering his powers for the first time. He's just having a whale of a time. And so, combination of reasons to do with the backgrounds, to do with the performance of the young actor, to do with the weight and the issues they had, even though the principal photography was gorgeous, they ended up replacing vast amounts of it with completely digital environments. And I think this is particularly funny because there's one shot where the DOP has a crane moving from camera right to camera left. They have the young Clark on a 100-foot jump going straight up in the air. The DOP just manages to get it perfectly aligned so that on this wide shot the young Clark goes right between the lens and the sun, beautifully eclipsing it. And of course the whole thing's thrown out and reproduced digital.
You gotta love that.
Yeah, so that's all, and we've written that up in the written story as well as hearing about it in the podcast. We also hear about Rising Sun's work on the previous. They did that with Pixel Liberation Front. And it's really interesting to hear a company who is working on the previous all the way through to the final shots.
So, Tim,
well,
thanks
great.
For joining
us. Well, why don't we
us.
Go ahead and join that.
When did you first start with the
now?
Project?
Well, that would be back in roughly February of 2005, I think. So nearly a year and a half ago.
And you'd just come right off Harry Potter, hadn't you?
That's right, yeah. I was looking after the team up here in the Sydney office whilst Tony was the effects supervisor on that show. And I had to leave a little bit early to really start on this one. We sort of started building the pipeline back in February.
One thing I wanted to touch on, we spoke to Leo before about the Adelaide-Sydney thing, and of course Rising Sun has also got Rising Sun Research, and one of the tools from Rising Sun Research is CineSync, which was used on this film, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I think in the end all of the vendors were using it. I know Mark Stetson told me it was the most useful tool. It's almost like standing over the shoulder of, you know, doing a walk around. He was actually able to, you know, point, click, move his cursor around, and everybody could see exactly what he wanted, which is ideal.
In fact, when we were talking to John Bruno last week, he claimed that it was one of the significant tools that made X-Men possible over 10 facilities and was incredibly, you know, glowing in his reports of using it. It must be great to have Rising Sun Research as a resource you can fall back on.
Oh, it is. And it's not just the CineSync as well. We've also got another product, Equalize, which means that all of our monitors are all calibrated so they all match, which I think for this particular show was exceptionally useful because we're using the Panavision Panalog format HD cameras, which haven't been used before. So bit of an acid test for those.
How did you find the Genesis footage?
Really clean, actually. It was, in a way, almost analogous to 4K film scans.
Really?
They have their own sort of footprint. They have their own response curves and all that kind of stuff. It's Panavision, I think, has done a fantastic job with it.
Yeah, the absence of film grain, was that something you put back in to give it a more filmic look at the end, or was...
Interestingly enough, the chips that are used, they actually come with their own sort of digital noise, which is filmic in... in response. So it's not exactly like film grain, obviously, but so that did actually help the images, I think, a little bit. We did have to make sure that any CG that we applied, we had to make sure that we got the Genesis noise or digital grain, I suppose you could call it, back over the top so it matched the original plate.
So, as an effects unit, leaving research aside for a second, as Rising Sun Pictures, you guys did about what 100 and something shots on the film?
106, I think, is the final total.
And so, I think that some of you mentioned going out to Tamworth when you first started on the film. That was for the young Clark sequences, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was for the farm flashback sequence where he flashes back to himself as a kid, just reminiscing. There's also another sequence there which comes just before that in the film called Kent Farm. I don't know if I can give spoilers in this. I'm not sure.
People are listening to this after the film's in cinemas.
Ah, okay. Well, there's a certain sequence when Superman returns, I think, which is quite special. There was another sequence where basically Martha Kent is sort of doing the dishes and something like a meteorite comes down from the sky and lands. I don't want to give too much away just in case people are listening to this who haven't seen the movie, but those are the two sequences that we were up there in Tamworth for. And I mean, I must admit, it was the location set was just awesome. Guy Diaz, who's the production designer who's worked with Brian Singer before, did a fantastic job. I mean, we just literally built a farm out of nothing. It was like, I think, 5 acres of cornfield, the farmhouse, the barn, all these other bits and pieces, and all built apparently to Australian building specifications.
Wow. Tell me, was that the crystal ship that you're referring to, or was that not you?
Yeah, and the crystal ship was the third set that we had up there. It was built life-size.
And so did it help having your previs team, passing stuff through?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it's with a storyboard, you get a really good idea of the story that the director wants to tell, but it's tough to try and make still images actually sort of call to you so you can understand what camera angles you need to shoot from, whether you need multiple setups for a single scene or whether you can get away with a single setup, whereas obviously with the whole previous team going, it suddenly starts to gel together. You can really see, okay, well, for this shot I'm going to need two cameras, you know, A camera, B camera, blah, 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 blah. So it saves a lot of time and effort, which I guess sort of for the studio's benefit, that translates into saving money, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Talking about the crystal ship, Gus Dias, I pronounce his name right there, the production designer, said that he wanted that to have an unearthly glow quality, a bit like deep sea creatures. And they obviously did a lot of work with physical sets, but did you have to replicate that digitally?
The only thing we had to do, I think, for the crystal ship after it crashed was just adding a little bit of heat haze and stuff like that. So it was very marginal for us on that one. It was because the props guys did such a fantastic job building it and interior lighting and all that sort of stuff.
And on the young Clark thing, just jumping back to the original 1978 Richard Donner version, which, you know, was a great film. But if we were to be a bit cruel about one shot, it was Clark running beside the train, which was clearly a wire rig off a truck. Mm. And it just perhaps pushed the boundaries of what was, I mean, to be unkind, it didn't look that good. But, you know, it was obviously part of a good film. But you guys got to do that shot again properly, really, didn't you?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, obviously, this was young Clark running through cornfields. Same thing. No trains in this particular one. He's out for a jog and a run and going out to have some fun. It was a combination of practical wire rigs used for making sure that we had all the camera moves, making sure it's this kind of almost like a live action previs for some of the shots, where we found that no matter how well we actually managed to capture stuff in camera, we still couldn't quite get the right movement for young Clark. So what we ended up doing was using some of the background plates or some of the original plates that were shot, keeping the camera, keeping a few bits and pieces of the shot, like some of the distant corn and stuff like that, and literally replacing everything else CG so we could get in there and reanimate young Clark. I think that was probably one of the most challenging things for us in that particular sequence, was actually just trying to make a young kid who's, you know, looks like anyone else to be running at like 50-60 miles an hour.
It's an incredibly difficult job because of the problem with weight, you know, and not only that, but get any effect like that that is close to what people know in their own realism, but of course completely fake, must be a very difficult challenge. Were there any sort of particular things about, I mean, for example, how did you actually go about doing the whole digital double? Where was the scanning done?
Well, scanning was done at a facility on Fox. Going to have to apologise to these guys. I can't actually remember the name of the company, but we basically got Stefan Bender, who was a young clerk, for, put up in a sort of skin tight costume, and then he would go to the scanning equipment and did a full body scan of him, so that we had his limbs, everything all to exactly to scale. And then Dan Kripak, who's one of our genius TDs, built the rig that this skin was going to go on top of, and built all the muscle deformations and all these kind of bits and pieces and all the cloth fins. It was all built in Maya, with sort of various little proprietary plugins and bits and pieces thrown over the top to make sure it worked properly. And initially, when we first started quoting on this, we weren't expecting to do full frame close-ups of young Clark, but as we progressed through the story and as the shooting progressed, as we were up in Tamworth, we realised that there were certain shots where he wasn't just going to be quarter size in frame, he was going to be full size in frame. So that was something that was a good challenge for Dan, because it meant he had a real go at making the best digital double we could do, and it looked fantastic.
What was that actually rendered in? Was it whose renderer were you using?
Combination. I think we were using Liquid up here. We got various different bits and pieces that we use, pretty much a bit of everything.
Because you use XSI and Maya, really, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this particular show, we use Maya and Liquid. We've got another show running down in the Adelaide office, which with a little bit of overflow coming up to the Sydney office, which is Charlotte's Web, and that's mainly using XSI.
And what about your compositing pipeline? Are you in favour of like multi-pass rendering, or is it more that you prefer to get it nailed in 3D and then have compositing on other things?
It's a tricky one. Some shots lend themselves to trying to get it as close as you possibly can in 3D and then pumping out a beauty pass and integrating that in 2D. But I think 9 times out of 10 it's better to do multi-pass stuff, certainly at the beginning and middle of a project. Because the director's requirements for a shot may change a little bit or a lot depending upon how the story's cutting together. And so you don't want to paint yourself into a corner by doing everything in 3D, because the iterations obviously are very, very expensive when it comes to time. Whereas if you bang out the multi-passes, you can change levels and change lighting and change your grades very simply in 2D just by sort of typing in a few numbers, and you don't have to wait for the overnight render to come back through again. You can see it almost instantaneously.
And your compositing pipeline from 3D, what's that?
We're using Shake. That's our main compositing package. Nothing else, actually. That's it on the 2D side of things.
Does Apple's decision to discontinue Shake and go for a new version really affect you, or is it your planning horizons are per film and you'd probably feature lock anyway, wouldn't you?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's when we it depends on the length of the project, really. But I mean, if it's going to be a 3-month project, we'd lock the whole file system at the beginning of the project. If it's in this case, because it's a year and a half project, we left it fairly volatile, so that we were able to version up or down as we needed. But the pipeline that we have in place, everything is backwards switchable. So if we updated to a new version of a particular piece of software, whether it was written in-house or purchased such as Shake, for any reason, if we wanted to drop down 2 versions because a facility that we had 2 versions ago is no longer available, then it's just a flick of a switch. So, and it's all artist based. It's not like a whole global switch that we have to flip.
And and clearly you've got some brilliant Shake artists working on your team, and they're doing really, really great work. Tell me, one of the things you mentioned earlier was getting that idea of an iterative process with the director. And I mentioned one of the sections of the film that you worked on that would have been very much like that was the X-ray sequences. Can you talk to us about those?
Definitely. We did a few X-ray shots. There's one where Superman's basically looking through into Lois's house just to check out the house, see what's happening inside there. And another one was Clark Kent is watching Lois as she ascends in an elevator. So obviously those two would require a certain amount of on-set stuff, and the rest of it was done digitally. Let me mention just the X-ray work in the house. In the house stuff. I mean, initially that started off with we shot a live action plate out on location at the house that they were using, the downstairs scenes in where was it? I can't remember the actual place, just sort of North Sydney somewhere. From that, the only part of the piece of live action that we used was actually the looking through into the kitchen from outside. Now the rest of the house, we had to then build digitally as an asset, and yeah, it was a very rough asset. This is more for like a pre-visualization, so that we could then work out camera moves as to how Superman is going to look through the top floor, look through the downstairs, to get back to this point of looking in through the kitchen window at the end of the shot. And that was Carl Goodfell built that up for us using set surveys that we'd done at the time in the house, and reconstructed it, and found also that the upstairs was going to be different to what the location was, so that was going to be built on the soundstage at Fox. And we had to obviously be able to marry all these elements together, so upstairs, downstairs. It's just rather tough actually explaining it without having something to point at and make sticky fingerprints on the screen. But essentially what it was is many passes using motion control of the upstairs that was built, that we created the art department built on set, and doing each pass taking out another piece of furniture or a wall or whatever, and then rebuilding that in 3D, because what we were going to be using, one of the processes of the X-ray was that Superman gets to, he doesn't just do things like an X-ray, but it's more like an MRI or a CT scan, where he actually slices through the atomic structure.
Right. So less of like a Fresnel pass and more of a detailed visual representation?
Kind of. How do I put this? There's when you have, I mean, as most people who've used 3D packages know, a 3D object that you build in something like Maya or 3ds Max or whatever isn't actually fully three-dimensional in that it's a surface. There's no actual volume inside.
Sure.
So what we had to do, if we're going to X-ray through a solid object, you have to see the solidity of what you're X-raying through, and so peeling away the layers. So we wrote a specific tool separately, which is our X-ray eat-through tool. So what that would do is that would take the files that were created in 3D, which are like the surface bits and pieces, and then fill it with the volume. So it's like a volumetric shader, but with very specific and controllable clipping planes. And those clipping planes were influenced by the material that was being cut through.
Right.
So, for instance, if you had, say a piece of wood, and you want to slowly eat your way through that piece of wood, the grain in the wood tends to be harder and slightly denser than the sort of like the pulp of the wood. So
yep.
As we would cut through a piece of wood, then the grain would be actually raised just a little bit, and the pulp, because the pulp is easier to cut through because it's less dense.
Yep. And of course, you're avoiding the sort of simple, previously done kind of look of the X-ray thing, which is really just a kind of an edge pass, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So we're actually trying to make it as... We made it as three-dimensional as it is possible to get, because it was fully three-dimensional volumetric shaders that had to be written for each of the substances that we were going to be cutting through.
But with the best...
work. It was, Dan Bethel was the TD, the sort of the brains behind building the mechanics and all that sort of stuff. And David Scott, who was with us as art director for this show, he and I worked pretty closely together right at the beginning as we were going through concepts with Mark Stetson. And I think this is quite a lot of it is due to David's take on what Brian had briefed, what Mark had briefed, what I briefed him with. And he went away and came back with some fantastically beautiful concept art, which when we were away on when production was away on hiatus, we had I think about a 3 to 4 week hiatus when Brian went back to the States, and so David put this stuff together, and by the time he came off hiatus, Brian had seen these shots. It's like, oh yeah, we've got to have them in the movie, and that was it. Okay. Yeah, the rest is history, or will be when you have a look at the movie.
Was the concept art done as like 3D, or was at that stage still just a kind of photoshopped interpretation?
It was a photoshopped interpretation at that stage. Even though, I mean, we'd already been in consultation with production, and we'd already started building the cut through tool. But it's one thing to start building and enabling the pipeline. But it's another to actually be able to sell the concepts, and we tried to run those both together.
And did that give you a pause of, oh my God, how are we going to pull this off? Or did you always, at that stage, have it pretty much under control technically?
I think we knew exactly what we wanted to do technically as well as conceptually. I think probably the concept side of it was the hardest one to nail, because, I mean, technically, we've got such a depth of talent here. I mean, there's so many people who've worked all around the planet who've decided to settle in Sydney and Adelaide and join us over the years, that the amount of experience we've got is pretty huge. So it's going over the technical side of things and briefing everybody on how and what we needed tool-wise was probably the simpler part of it. The actual trying to show Brian the concepts that we were translating from his briefs, that was the toughest challenge, I think, out of the whole thing.
Well, it's obviously done you guys incredibly well, and it's so good to see the way that Rising Sun has evolved into the facility it is, because really you've had a spate of good films as a facility, and every one almost bigger than the next, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. It's been an interesting journey. It's been a lot of fun. I don't know whether when Tony, Wayne and Gail started this company, what was it, 10 and a half, 11 years ago, whether they realised exactly how big they'd get, but you can't do much better than what we've got so far on our plate. There's been some fantastic projects to work on.
Well, we're looking forward to the DVD and some of the making of footage, and so we can understand a bit more, but it's been really, really great talking to you. Thank you so much for giving us your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Mike.
Well, thanks, Tim, for taking the time to speak with us this week. In part two of our podcast this week, Mike Seymour is going to be speaking with Leo Baker, and Leo was the XSI 3D previs lead for Rising Sun Pictures on Superman Returns. So let's go to that interview now.
So tell me, when did you first get involved with the project?
I got sent over to Sydney from Adelaide, November last year, to start working with the guys from the Pixel Liberation Front on previs for Superman Returns.
So for people that don't know, can you explain the situation with Rising Sun Pictures and both the Adelaide and Sydney setup?
Well, there's two offices for Rising Sun. There's one in Adelaide in the city, and one in Redfern in Sydney. The two offices very similar and connected, and Sydney gets some slightly different projects to Adelaide at times, depending on the nature of the project. Superman was being shot in Sydney, so it kind of made sense for the Sydney office to be largely involved with the finished visual effects of the project. However, all of the previs was being done in XSI, so Adelaide is predominantly an XSI house in terms of 3D package, so I got sent over because I've been working with the XSI team here.
So let me ask you about that. Firstly, why XSI? Was that a PLF decision, or was that something that, I know you guys have both XSI and Maya.
Yeah, that was a PLF decision. That's their in-house 3D package of choice, for which they already had a lot of assets developed, particularly camera rigs and methods for translating the camera rigs back to on-set data for motion capture or specific details for replicating the shots in the real world, so they had chosen that. Also, there's a lot of OpenGL capabilities with Exercise, a lot of OpenGL texturing, which is quite suited for previs because you don't have to go through an extensive rendering process. The OpenGL capturing is quite quick for a faster turnaround when presenting the previs.
So in broad brushstrokes, was this the sort of previs where you wanted to get it like within a, you know, a centimeter of where you wanted the camera to be with exactly the right lens, or was it more like nutting out the beats of the film? How technical was the previs?
Previs was actually, it turned out to be extremely technical. I've just recently seen the trailers, and I've seen a lot of our shots on the trailers for Superman Returns, and they have matched our previs absolutely accurately, which is great for us. But it goes to show how much they really treated the previs as gospel for producing the final look of the film. I mean, we paid special attention to lenses and framing, but it turns out that the previs was more than just timing and composition. It actually went into quite a lot of detail, for which it even shows in the actors' actions and frames, like they're actually matching our previs. So it actually went down to quite an extensive level, including quite a lot of character animation.
So you'd had to work very closely with Brian Singer and Mark Stetson during this period, because, of course, this is really the experimentation period, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's quite a flexible period as well. I mean, a lot of the sequences, particularly the larger action sequences, we reworked entirely several times, which could become tedious at times, but it also was a really creative process. And, a lot of direct contact with Mark Stetson and Brian Singer. We would show the work we did each day to Brian. He would come in and review, like in an editorial scenario. We had a previous editors who would cut all of our previews together. So it was actually like the post process you would do with editing, figuring out a cut, but we're actually doing it beforehand. So figuring out pace and, you know, the drama building in each scene. And and he would make comments, and then we would adjust to that. And there was actually a lot of involvement from other departments as well. Like, we had a lot of the obviously a lot of involvement from art department coming in, and they would help them figure out what they would need to build in terms of sets for what, you know, the camera was going to see. And also a lot of the engineer guys would come in and build a lot of the large rigs, like the Boeing 777 rig, and I think there was some other rigs had to make for some the smaller light aircraft and boats and things like that. They had to figure out exactly how much was being seen, and then what to build from there.
I was going to ask you about that, because in a highly technical previs, it must be an enormous collection of assets, because not only do you have to make up the stuff that's going to be CG in the final picture, like the plane, but also all the stuff that isn't CG that's just going to be being shot.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of assets for us, making our models and what we used in the previs, we had a direct link with art department, so we got a lot of their 3D files, which were generated in Rhino, which a lot of them were NURB surfaces, which we had to convert to kind of more lower resolution versions for us to use in our previs. But we had a lot of kind of model assets from them, and then a lot of the remaining assets we had to make. But I mean, a lot of that could be kind of cheered. I mean, further background assets can just be like a background card or something to get an idea of what the environment is like. But there were some quite involved sets for some of them, and there was actually a model of like a low-res model of all of Manhattan, which is, you know, Metropolis. So we used that and a variety of other assets, but. It was really cool actually having that relationship with the art department, and then further set building. And we actually, we're at Fox Studio, so we could actually see them building the sets as per our previous layouts, which was quite exciting.
How far did you take the lighting on those?
The lighting of the previs?
Yeah, I mean, was it still very crude in terms of lighting, or did you actually get to play around with where the light would be in some of the...
Yeah, well, it was pretty crude. I mean, it wasn't there wasn't so much an indication of light direction or of lighting setup, which the cinematographer would replicate. It wasn't that involved, but it was there was a basic template light rig for some of the scenes, which was one of the PLF tools actually they had, which oriented itself relative to the camera, so you always kind of had a continuity of lighting set up just for the OpenGL display, which was quite primitive, but it just allowed for a continuity of each shot, so you didn't have dramatic differences when you have multiple artists working on different shots for the same sequence.
You've got a really interesting background coming from having worked on set and both photography of your own and as a camera assistant. Can you tell us about that and how that relates to your ability to, you know, to use the right lenses and to use the right feel in the electronic previs?
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, it has a direct relationship, which really helps. I mean, when I was working on sets, I worked as a camera assistant, so I worked mainly on a lot of TV commercials, but I did a couple of quite larger budget films, and on those films, I worked on Mission Impossible 2 in Sydney, and then we had, at one stage, 12 cameras, which was a bit of a nightmare at the time, but there was a lot of lenses and a lot of camera gear, and working on set with lenses, I mean, you're seeing the type of shot, whether it's a mid-shot or a close-up or wide master, like, you know, you kind of get to know the type of lenses that are being used and relative to the film format and framing. So it was really good. That's one part I really enjoyed, but the previews was, Mark Stetson would come around and I'd be talking to him about a shot and, you know, where it fit in the sequence, you know, like how the drama was building up, and we're discussing whether it would be worth going in for a close-up at that stage in the sequence or whether it would be better to stay as a mid-shot or a two-shot or whatever, and, you know, the kind of rough standards and guidelines for what kind of lenses you would use in that situation. And and with that as well, because we had the flexibility and the speed of just being able to change it in the computer quite quickly, you could push it quite a fair way. Like, you know, you could go, well, let's try a really extreme close-up, let's try, you know, 100mm or 135mm on this scenario, and then cut back to an extreme wide or whatever. I mean, a lot of the time, you know, you can try testing a lens on set, but you can't actually see it in the cut. I mean, we could actually, you know, like do a brief capture and then look at it in the cut and just go, you know, that's really great and it really adds to the story, or no, it's getting a bit silly, it's pushing a bit too far. But it was good to have that flexibility, but it was good to be able to offer up lenses and framing based on what film experience I'd had previously.
And tell me, what resolution were you doing these previses at, and how did you get a sense of how it would play on a big screen?
Well, it was all done just at like a PAL resolution, like 720 or 540 or whatever was compatible with the system we were cutting on, just as an idea to get a size and a preview of what we were working at. But it all had, like, you know, proper masking, like 235 anamorphic masking. And I mean, the cameras they used for shooting was the new digital Genesis camera, I think it's called. Yeah,
the Genesis.
Which, you know, kind of translate. They were using spherical lenses, so it kind of translates to like the equivalent of shooting sort of Super 35 with spherical lenses for Super 35 with a 235 mask in that. So we just basically replicated that. So everything we were seeing was the translated directly to the lenses and the cropping format.
So you've discussed the way the art department might have models that came to you, and then you'd incorporate that in the previs. What about passing your models on to someone either in visual effects or in motion control? Was there any file transfer from you guys on?
I believe some of the previous scenes got handed off mainly for obtaining the camera moves if they had large CG components, so they could actually have the camera moves to start working with that would, you know, match what the director originally saw. But a lot of the assets were scaled down to be low-res assets, and I'm not sure in detail where a lot of that came from. I imagine a lot of the highly detailed stuff would have to have been recreated, but mainly just camera moves, I would say, yeah.
This is probably an impossible question, but in terms of, like, shooting ratio, to use that concept, I mean, how much was it a matter of you had storyboards and you blocked the scenes, and how much was it that you would iteratively go over and over and over trying to work out action sequences in the previous stage? Because obviously it's a good time to do it.
Well, that's the main thing we did. I mean, we really sweated on the action sequences. There were some key sequences which, had been roughed out by storyboards, but we really needed to discover how it was going to work at the previous stage. So, I mean, the storyboards gave an initial indication, but sometimes they just weren't really showing enough, and we ended up changing a lot of that. So the previews essentially became the platform of storyboards that the director could work from, and we ended up changing quite a lot. And it was really great. We had a lot of room to move there with offering up our own ideas and creativity towards the scene. And Mark Stetson was really open to us offering up ideas because, you know, we're all there involved working with the project, and, you know, and it's an ideal way to use all these artists working towards the same goal to offer up different ideas, and they really let us run with that. And a lot of our own ideas and flair that we put into it is actually in the film now, which is really rewarding.
Well, it must have been cool for you to be working on such an iconic film with even people like Marlon Brando in it.
Yeah, absolutely it was. I mean, it became more exciting as it went along because, you know, it developed. And but yeah, I mean, it was really amazing to just see the trailers, and they have, some of the shots that we did, like, they've absolutely matched the lens, the framing, and even the action, even the actors. I mean, I wonder how the actors feel having to act based on some crude character animation.
Is there a particular shot
out of the models, but
is there a particular
reenact what a proxy human character animated on?
Is there,
GL capture.
Is there a shot from the trailer that you're referring to that you can tell us which one you're referring to?
Well, there's a few different trailers. There's a few shots in there where, I mean, it's all quite quickly cut, but there's a few shots where Superman lands on the Kryptonite Island at the end of the movie, and when he's falling from the sky. I mean, there's all different. I mean, we did most of the film in previews, so there's a whole lot of different sections of the
right.
film. One of the coolest sequences, the plane crash, was already sort of already previews. That was like the starting eye-catching previews sequence that PLF did before they came over to Australia. So that was already kind of planned out. That features quite heavily in the trailers. They had already done that one, but most of the other large sequences, like the bank robbery and the ending of the film, we did all that kind of stuff. And there's some snippets of that featured in the trailers.
Tell me, how many were in your team just finishing up?
Oh, well, it grew and it grew. Let me think. It started off with five of us, and I think it ended up with 11 or 14, and then there was also a whole lot of extra guys from the PLF brought on, extra four or five guys. So I think at one stage there was 20 previous artists.
Well,
it was great.
Well, thanks very much for taking time to talk to us.
No worries. Cheers. Thank you.
Well, that was great. Thanks, Leo, and thanks, Tim, for taking the time to talk to us. Mike, that was really, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, it is, and it's really good with these big films that we're getting a chance to talk to a number of the facilities to find out who contributed, because everybody is these days contributing, you know, normally their own sequence or their own part of the film.
Yeah, and to that end, also in the online story, as Mike mentioned earlier, where they're covering more stuff, and it includes some of the digital Marlon Brando stuff, where they actually had to replace his jaw and mouth to get him to say lines. They'd actually recorded some lines of his in the past, off-camera and in Foley for use, and didn't use them. So it's all him saying the lines, but they didn't actually have him on camera actually mouthing them. So Rhythm and Hughes did a lot of work to recreate that, and so that's covered in our online story. Fascinating stuff as well.
Yeah, one of the other interesting things is that Rhythm and Hughes did a whole lot of water work in the sea rescue scene, and it's interesting after our Poseidon story to talk to them, because they took a really different approach to the water reconstruction work than the fluid dynamics that ILM did. So that's another interesting aspect.
Yeah,
but yeah, no, it's good to read.
Good stuff, and again, a great anniversary podcast, I'd say, Mike. Again, it's been a fun year, and I hope everyone's enjoyed listening to them. I personally have.
Yeah, no, it's astonishing. I think we've done almost exactly 24 hours worth of podcasting in the last year. Some of them were video podcasts, but all of them are on iTunes. Well, not all of them, actually. The secret, super bowl one is you had to have got that when it came out, because it's not available anymore. But apart from that, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's been fun stuff. So, again, thanks for listening all year, and thanks for listening this week. And until next week, for Mike Seymour, who's here, I'm John, and Jeff Huser, John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.